I mean, what's Pro Football Focus doing? Last week they had Brady. This week they got Brady.
We're doing it. We're literally doing it differently from everybody else.
Hey, as a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PFF.
Do you not understand that they are that way because you're Joe Flacco?
And you just like to discredit things that people deserve credit for.
That you can't possibly be expected to defend that.
Talk about the game, Sam.
So,
who cares about what people think about us?
Yeah, I like football. I like football season and all the things that go with it.
Welcome into the PFF NFL podcast. Steve Pelizzolo back here with Sam Monson. It is part four of our NFL draft review. We could maybe, do you want to stretch it into two more shows?
No.
Let's do one team per show.
No.
This is it.
Mm-hmm.
This is the last we're going to talk about the draft.
Mm-hmm.
When we hit June, by the way, I almost forget what happened in the draft. It's like cramming for a test. Forget what happened in the draft. You got to remember again, come training camp.
Yeah. Got to decompress for a while and then you're back to the next season.
Yeah, we don't decompress, though. No. We go to only two shows a week.
Well, that is decompressing for us.
Yeah, it is.
Wednesday show.
So that's what's happening soon. This will be our last week with three-plus shows. This is our fourth show of the week. Appreciate everybody tuning in and being a part of our draft review. We've already done three-quarters of the league. Today, it's going to be AFC South, AFC West to wrap up our draft reviews. Next week, we're going into our off-season PFF NFL podcast schedule, which is going to be Monday, 9 a.m., live on YouTube, Thursday, 10:30 a.m. Eastern, live on YouTube, and of course the audio showing up just a little bit after that. So back to Monday, Thursday, and we'll get back to our three shows almost certainly next year, probably right around training camp, preseason, whenever that might be. So just a little heads up. And then PFF NFL Daily listeners and viewers, we will probably have one more week of dailies. And we go on sabbatical for that show as well, just as a heads up. We did that last year, came back around July or August. So just a heads up, the daily is going to take a little break. So make sure, if you're not subscribed yet, hit that subscribe button so that you're ready for when we get back.
Yep.
Next season. Sound good?
Mm-hmm.
Now, Titans fans are already feeling slighted. They're already nervous that we're going to forget them. They're scheduled to go last here on this show.
Okay.
Or do you want to flip them to the front? What do you want to do?
I leave it in your capable hands. If you forget them, it's your fault.
No, they'll go fourth here. Let's start in the AFC South with who'd be in the AFC South first? Houston? Houston Texans. Let's go. Houston Texans first up here in our AFC South and AFC West review. You have anything else at the top of the show here you need to discuss?
No.
Before we get into the Texans?
I was curious what your take on the Champions League yesterday was.
It was madness, as someone would tell me. Look, it's just a back and forth battle. You have underdogs, you know, making a run, but you know, at some point, the better teams win.
Yeah,
yeah.
Uh huh. So, which one did that happen?
Yes,
the better team won.
Yes.
Okay.
Right. I mean, it was Chiefs Bills reincarnate.
I see.
Chiefs Bills.
Okay.
Was it not? When you have Patrick Mahomes, good things happen.
Absolutely. Benzema.
Do you have an actual answer?
I just, Real Madrid, make no sense. They
nobody cares about that.
They shouldn't be in the final. They're still there. They keep winning.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
It's crazy.
It doesn't make any sense. But Benzema's a big reason why.
You want to talk about our hometown Reds?
No.
They've won three games in 5 weeks.
That's not great.
You play every day. That's really bad. I'm going to go check a Reds game out on Saturday. It might be one of the, my family might make up half the people.
Maybe you can get, at the stadium. Maybe you could try it for them.
I might be able to make the Reds at this point.
We show them that sped up video, you know, the one that looks like 95 instead of 74.
Yeah. They would sign me.
Right.
I worked with their pitching coach back in the day.
Yeah. Like, here's the video. Don't ask any questions.
Yeah. Well, they're 3-21 right now. It's not good. Our friend Kirk Herbstreit, diehard Reds fan, not happy right now. Not happy. Anyway, let's get into it. Houston Texans, they did stuff. It's great. The Texans did things that are going to make their team better. So, like, A+.
Wow.
Just go with A+.
We'll go that far. But
Where's the link? I need the where's the grades here?
They made some moves. What do we got here? Houston Texans are pretty high. Eighth on the composite thing with a GPA of...
John McClain gave him an A, right?
Yeah. John McClain liked it on the way out the door.
John McClain when
3.09. This is another one that had the A from John McClain and the F from Thor.
Yeah, Thor didn't like where anybody went. Does he hate Derek Stingley? Like, what's his deal?
You would have to, right, to give him an F?
Yeah, I saw Thor explaining things. He does. We've talked a lot about the teams that have second rounders only and third rounders only and all that stuff really getting screwed in the rankings, and Thor does take that into consideration. He tries to only evaluate based off who they picked and where, you know, based off his board. Obviously, it's based off his own opinion. So I think he tries to stay strict with that, and if they make reaches on his board, he's gonna trash him for it. So I haven't read his work, but I assume the two top picks probably weigh heavily, and that Derek Stingley and Kenyon Green, the two first-round picks for the Houston Texans, much lower on Thor's board over at NBC Sports Edge.
Yeah, I mean, you would have to hate, I think, Derek Stingley as a prospect to give this draft a really bad grade. And there are people that presumably do, right? If you're looking at, we've been preaching all along that, hey, showing elite play is more important than when you showed it. If, on the other hand, you're of the opinion that, hey, it's kind of important that the guy wasn't good the last 2 years, and therefore taking him at number three overall is a travesty, then I guess I can at least see the argument of why you would think this is a bad bad draft and a bad grade. I would disagree pretty vehemently, but I would assume that's the logic. Kenyon Green in the middle of the first round, I think, is a fairly significant reach. I don't love John Mechie in the second round. So I can kind of get there, but I don't really agree.
Texans had four picks in the top 44. We gave them a B+, by the way, over at PFF. The Derek Stingley pick at three, I'm excited by it for the Texans, right? I mean, we did discuss at one point, you've got Nick Caserio drafting. It's his first round draft pick, right? They didn't have one last year, if I remember. Right, they didn't have anything last year for a while. It's actually a lot like the Bears this year. You've got this depleted roster in Houston the last couple years, and they didn't have the draft capital to make it better, kind of like the Bears going into this draft. But it's the first-round pick for Nick Caserio. I'm having flashbacks of other Belichick types and Scott Pioli taking Tyson Jackson, you know, a little five tech in the first round back in 08, I believe it was, or 09. But they tried to hit a home run, right? They went with the guy with the most upside, maybe in the entire draft, as far as what a number one corner can bring to the table. We also discussed pre-draft. Lovie Smith's system is not, you know, year 2000, play cover 250% of the time and every third down, right? They will play man coverage. They will play zone. And Stingley is certainly has all the tools to be exceptional in coverage, but he could do it all.
If you're looking at range of outcomes, right, outside of quarterback, obviously quarterback is the thing that determines wins and losses more than anything else, so war. Outside of a quarterback, the highest, if every single player in the draft hit the highest potential, the highest PFF war probably belongs to Derek Stingley. So from that perspective, the Texans have, you know, we talked about how the Jags swung for that home run, right? They're looking for special in a draft that doesn't have a ton of it. And that's why they took Trayvon Walker number one overall, because of that athletic profile and what he could become, even though there's no evidence that he is that right now. The Texans did the same thing with Derek Stingley, but they did it number three, and they went for the correct position in terms of what typically has the highest payoff if that dude hits. So the first glimpse of what Nick Caserio wants to do in terms of constructing a roster, building a franchise from a foundation piece, that's the first evidence we have. That dude swung hard for something that, if it hits, will make the biggest difference you can make outside a quarterback.
So completely agree there on Stingley. Thought that was cool. Kenyon Green at 15. Now they're playing it safer. Even though I think he's as risky of a prospect as Derek Stingley, his production isn't great at a position that does project pretty well. He was, you know, grades of at least 75 over the last couple of years. Nothing exceptional from a PFF standpoint. He's number 39 on our draft board. He goes at 15. But this is, I think this goes into the diversifying the portfolio bucket, where you get Kenyon Green, who's probably going to start at guard. They could start him at right tackle, right? I mean, there is that opportunity. I did not listen to their press conference. I don't know if they would have revealed that or not. But with, you know, Titus Howard heading into the last year of his contract as a former first rounder who has not worked out, So they have holes at guard. They have holes at right tackle. Kenyon Green has played all over the offensive line. He's played both guard spots. He's played right tackle. So that could be cool. That could work.
Why do you think there was such a big difference on where people ranked Kenyon Green? Because obviously the Houston Texans valued him mid first round pick, and I've seen people have him as low as mid second round pick, low second round pick. Renner, certainly the closer we got to the draft, was dropping him down the board at a rapid rate of knots. Why do you think there was such a big discrepancy on where people ranked Kenyon Green?
At a rapid rate of knots.
Yeah.
I love that. I think the flash plays, the high-end plays were there. Who are some of the early PFF guys? Who's the guard for the Bucks? Everybody thought was really good, and our grades didn't love him.
Davin Joseph.
Yeah. He was a first-rounder, too, I believe, back in the day, right?
He might be the best example of how first-round pick, in terms of reputation, will carry you a so absurdly long way. Because Davin Joseph, for years, PFF grades were saying, not a good player. And yet, former first-round pick, consistent starter in that, Tampa Bay never – he was a starter every time for Tampa Bay. They were never replacing him. And the argument was simply, well, Tampa Bay starts him every year. He's a former first-rounder, therefore he's good. We're like, well, he isn't, though. Look at the play-by-play grading. Like, look at him play. He's not. And then the very second Tampa Bay no longer started him, got rid of him, cut him, done. Like, immediately just out of the league. The dude didn't, I think, catch on anywhere else, didn't get another gig, just no more opportunities. So, literally, his reputation was built on, you are a first-round pick that starts for a team. And as soon as that ceased to be the case, there was no case anymore because nobody else picked him up.
So let me just—I think when you just read Renner's description in the PFF draft guide, which you could still get, by the way, and I'll give it to you for 25% off using the promo code NFL
Pod.
I will.
Okay.
Just from me. Sam can't do this. Mm-hmm. I can give it to you for 25% off using the promo code NFL Pod. Where he wins explosiveness, right? In that his pop on contact is special, right? I've seen the people that love Kenyon Green on Twitter and all that stuff. The highlight reel blocks, run game, smooth and pass protection, doing it from multiple positions, all of that stuff. Where can he improve? Hand usage, right? Hand usage shows up in the play-by-play grading, right? If you don't use your hands well, when you lose, when you whiff, he had a ton of penalties last year, right? So when hand position was way off and he ends up grabbing quite a bit from and got called for a ton of penalties last year. This reminds me a little bit of Davin Joseph and like the disconnect between the special things that he could do or the perception and then the play-by-play grading not being up there. Now, this isn't to say that Kenyon Green was terrible or anything like that. I'm just saying, where's the disconnect? I think his consistency was lacking, and some people did dive deep and factor that in, whereas the high-end stuff from Kenyon Green was really good, and people are like, oh, that's a mid-first-round pick. Here's what he can be. He's a can-do guy.
Right. That's a little bit where you've referred to it a lot as a safe pick relative to Derek Stingley. And I think you're right in terms of position value. Like, obviously,
like, they're viewing it as safe, as in, like, we're getting a starting guard.
Yeah. But it's the same theory in terms of we are shooting for high-end potential. We're shooting for the guys that have that spectacular top-end range of outcomes, even if it's actually quite a broad range. We're not shooting for a very narrow, tight, safe guy who we know will just be good right from day one. We're shooting from the guy that if he pans out and hits the top 10, 20% of his range of outcomes, he's special. So that to me is where it gets intriguing, because now what we're trying to do here is discern a pattern. What does Nick Caserio value when he's acquiring players of significance for the first time, right? Because the last sort of go-arounds he's had in terms of acquiring players, we don't know, because he's just been filling bodies that are going to last for a year and get turned over. This is the first opportunity we're going to see what he values when he's actually getting guys that he wants to stick around for an extended period of time in whatever he's building. And pick one, pick two are both the same in terms of broad spectrum of outcomes, but with stupidly high-end potential.
Jalen Pitre at 37. Overall, Baylor slot corner / safety. Interesting player, because I don't know what position he plays at the next level. I think he's got some free safety skills, but he was basically like a linebacker at Baylor. I think he could play a little free. Slot corner, I think, in the NFL in college, slot corner in college is a lot different than slot corner in the NFL. But I think those are becoming much closer to each other as well, right? Again, we always talk about the difference between man and zone. Playing slot and zone is a little bit different. You might have to play matchup or whatever. But Petre actually reminded me of his teammate now, Desmond King. Desmond King's still there, yeah. The current slot corner in Houston. If Desmond King played in the slot in college, covered well, played zone well, tackled well, had linebacker-ish type of skills, you know, actually reminded me of maybe a more athletic Desmond King, and he's going to go in there and maybe try to compete with him at slot corner.
Yeah, this one, it's a little bit different to the first two in that I think Petrie's range of outcomes is probably tighter. I think he's going to be a good player. The question is, A, where, and B, are they looking for that jackpot matchup player? Like this guy that doesn't necessarily fill a conventional cookie-cutter position, but if he's able to turn into this matchup player, like this positionless weapon on defense, that's where his range of outcomes suddenly shoots through the roof. So, you know, Mike Renner was on this podcast and he was saying he's a slot corner. That's what he did. He covered the slot 100% at Baylor. That's what he is. He's not a safety. He's not a, like, he's a slot defender. And this is a good thing because when you look at how he plays, he actually, he defends the run better than linebackers from that position. It's not, he doesn't defend it the same, but defends it better than a lot of linebackers, can cover, can, you know, do all these things. When you watch his tape, he looks like a safety, though. Like, he has a safety's body. He's got safety movement skills. So to me, he's a classic kind of tweener that may just project straight to safety. But if Houston is looking at this and saying, this is a dude that has legit slot corner skills in a safety's body, and, you know, actually is better against the run than typically those types of players are, that is starting to create building blocks of that positionless defense, right? This,
yeah,
the same things that people were talking about with Isaiah Simmons, right, when he went in the top 10 to Arizona. Now he's not
Jeremy Chin,
different body Panthers type, different physical skill set, exactly, but like these players now, they're becoming more and more common, and we are slowly edging towards this world where these guys that can do everything are the key to defense. When you've got offenses unlocking the potential of guys like Cordero Patterson because you can move him around the formation and defenses can't match up, players like Jalen Petre are the types of players that let you match up. You can just put Petre on the field and say, you're like it, almost man-marking, like in soccer or another sport, right? You man-to-man, you are going where that guy goes. Doesn't matter if he's in the backfield, doesn't matter if you split out wide receiver, you are his man.
That's an interesting point there too, right? Because you do have receivers playing in the backfield now, right?
Yeah.
You do have more of that. So I love it. This evaluation is going to be a fun one to watch in the next couple of years. I do think he has safety skills that he did show at Baylor when he did line up deep. It's not like he never did it. So Petre there. And
a lot of those slot plays, by the way, just to cut you off, they show safety. They sort of morph into a safety play, right? Like he's covering the slot, but off coverage in quarters, which means he's just dropping into a deep, you know, he's playing safety at that point. At that point, that is the exact same role as simply lining up at free safety in a quarter system. You know what I mean? So
yeah,
there are plays that directly project to him being a safety, even if technically speaking, he's a slot corner on that play.
And even like when you play cover three, the strong safety is going to come down and play, you're going to play hook or you're going to play curls, or you're going to play zone,
right?
You're
going to
play, get depth, see the pass concept, break on it, or see the run game and you know, get to your run fit and all that stuff. And he does that stuff well. So Metchie at 44, I think for both of us, a little bit high, but I get it. Like, I get the speed and the quickness that he has. My question is the play strength, and he has the same injury concern Jameson Williams has.
True. There are also, by the way, this is another one of those ones where, look, I don't like John Metchie. I don't like Jahan Dotson. There are people that do. Both those guys, right? Now, Seth Galina on PFF, he loves John Metchie. Now, part of it is because John Metchie's Canadian,
of course,
as is Seth Galina. But he also points out, like, he is an exceptionally good route runner. And I think I will admit now, live on the podcast, that I think I probably underrated that aspect of John Metchie's game because I was underwhelmed at the other stuff, right? So this run of Alabama wide receivers, where you see them coming a year or two in advance because you're watching the last Alabama receiver to come out, the, you know, Henry Ruggs, Jerry Jeudy, all of a sudden you see coming down the line, Devontae Smith. You see Jalen Waddle. And then when you're each time when you're watching those guys, you see the next guy in the development line. When you were watching it and you saw John Metchie and you understood that that's the next guy down the line, you didn't see the plays on the previous guy's tape the way you did for everybody else. You saw the next guy coming and you were excited. You're like, well, next year might be even better. You didn't see that with John Metchie. And even when you go back and watch his tape, it's like, yeah, I mean, it's not bad. It's just it's not doing much for me. You know what I mean? But he is really good as a route runner. And that's important. I mean, that's the thing that I've said is, that would be my starting foundation piece if I'm looking for a wide receiver prospect. Can he run routes? Can he separate? If he can, now let's talk about what else he can bring to the table. He can do that. Now we've got to talk about what else he brings to the table, and I just don't think the rest of the stuff is particularly special.
I mean, what about just if he's a vertical slot? And when we're talking second-round receivers, unless they become A.J. Brown or Deebo Samuel, they're all
sure
second or third options, right? And they're going to have weaknesses. Here's what I'm excited for the Texans. Their first four picks are all contributing, right? Derek Stingley, Kenyon Green, we know they're going to start. Petrie's going to probably start at some point, whether it's slot, safety, whatever their role is. And Mechie's going to be a top three receiver sooner rather than later on this team when healthy. Christian Harrison, the third developmental linebacker prospect who can fly to the ball and hasn't been a great player. Damian Pierce, love him as a running back who's just tough to tackle. I think it reminds me a little bit of David Montgomery, where I think he's an early down player who's not great in the pass game, but like he's going to maximize what he gives you in the run game. And Pierce has a path to the field. They have Marlon Mack there ahead of him.
Always. Like this is the Houston Texans backfield. Any running back always has a pass to the
field. A path to the field. So I like the Texans draft overall. And I'm excited for Texans fans because I think after treading water for 2 years, they've got some players to be excited about.
And by the way, you know, even deeper down the draft, fifth round, Thomas Booker, interior defensive lineman out of Stanford. This is another guy who fits the pattern in terms of, look, a former top recruit, his the high end of his range of outcomes is high. It's just that we haven't seen that for a while. Like his college career was underwhelming compared with where expectations were. But this is another, like this is looking like the pattern for Nick Caserio, is we are shooting for players that may have a broad range of outcomes, but the high end is spectacular.
And I'll tell you what, if you pair this with their free agent strategy, not that for the next 5 years, you don't necessarily want them to sign 20 guys who are all backups and low-end starters and special teamers, but if you're at least trying to hit home runs in the draft, it meshes well with a free agent strategy, which is get the lower middle class NFL player on 1 and 2 year contracts, and now you have the diversified roster. It finally meshes a little bit because there's a lot of potential in this draft class, I think.
There is. I don't know how connected those are. To me, my analysis of their free agencies for the last couple of years has been essentially, I don't think they're actually trying to achieve anything. I honestly think they were literally just making moves for the sake of making moves and turning over a roster so that in a year's time they can do it all over again, waiting for Deshaun Watson to get the hell out of town. Now Deshaun Watson is out of town. This draft has been the first look at what the approach is. I don't think that the last two free agency classes are connected in any way. And I think next year's free agency, we probably see a completely different approach.
Going to look different.
To Houston. Now, that's just my reading of the tea leaves, as they say. You might be right, and there might actually be a synergy between the two where we shoot for high end in the draft and we just get like guaranteed low end roster guys in free agency, and that might be exactly the same thing we see next year, but my guess would be it isn't.
I don't want to harp on it anymore, but yeah, I mean, a lot of what Houston did in free agency was kind of Patriots-like, but the Patriots always had the foundation already in place,
right.
So it didn't seem crazy. So. Mm-hmm. Reminder that the PFF NFL podcast is sponsored by Western and Southern Financial Group. Luckily, you've got first pick in selecting the right money moves. Do you need life insurance? What about help planning for your financial goals? Don't pass on this round. No trading down here with Western and Southern. Use your position to expand your financial education and learn more with information on life insurance, investing, and retirement planning at westernsouthern.com/draft. That's right. We moved it to westernsouthern.com/draft. Appreciate Western and Southern being the presenting sponsor here on the PFF NFL podcast.
I wonder if they've been in touch with Deebo Samuel. I can't believe you ignored the news of the day. You, the Instagram correspondent.
Oh, what happened now?
Deebo has refollowed the San Francisco 49ers.
Really?
On Instagram.
We might have to redo all of our NFC West analysis from earlier in the week.
Re-followed. The world is healed.
Good for them. Now, what did they do? I mean, then the 49ers are like the model franchise here because they made whatever moves they made behind the scenes to earn the refollow. Like, it's a copycat league. You, like, hire that social media director, right? The 49ers social media director, whatever they did is going to be coveted around the NFL because you got to know how to deal with younger millennials / older Gen Z, right?
Yeah. I don't know.
There's something to be learned here.
Well, I don't know if it's necessarily like a successful social media victory strategy from them or simply the draft is passed. You're not getting traded.
Oh, maybe that's a strategy.
What's your plan? You know what I mean?
Stand firm.
Yeah. Like, does he just, I mean, let's say, for example, that that was the answer and all of a sudden, like, what does Debo do? Just sit there not following the 49ers for the next year until he finally, you know, something happens, playing for them the whole way? No,
maybe he just doesn't want the hype from the Niners. He just wants to stay focused.
I mean, maybe.
All right, we're going to go for 5 hours here today. The pace is not great.
No?
We're on pace for a four-hour show.
Oh, yeah, that's taking a while.
The Texans deserve some love. Listen.
I'm just saying the longer
we're giving the Texans extra love today.
The longer we spend on the Texans, the less time we're going to be spending on the Titans, and that's going to make people mad.
We might have to push the Titans to another day. We'll see. Indianapolis Colts are up next. Where did they land in this hole? They're in the middle somewhere, aren't they? Nobody loved the Colts. 13th. They were 13th. B-plus from PFF. 13th on the consensus. I like the Colts draft. I'm Mr. Positive here. I like most of the drafts.
Yeah, I think this was a better draft than middle of the road, middle of the pack.
Here's the thing. We know the bias for teams that don't have first-round picks.
Yes.
For the Colts to rank 13th here is a minor miracle without a first-round pick.
I personally gave this draft an A-.
I like your personal grades.
Yeah.
I'm with you. What'd you like about the Colts draft here? Started with Alec Pierce at 53, wide receiver from Cincinnati. Jelani Woods, the tight end from Virginia at 73. Those were their first two picks. And Bernard Raimann at 77.
I like their first three picks. I think Alec Pierce is a good wide receiver. I think he's underrated relative to how everybody else was viewing this class. I also think he meshes really well with Michael Pittman Jr. So not only is it a good addition in a vacuum, it's a good addition specifically for the players that you already have. You made me question my kind of view, my initial reaction to Alec Pierce tape, you know, the impressions I was getting coming away. But Seth, during the live shows, made me kind of back me up, like made me go, no, I was right. I wasn't crazy. I think he can play that X receiver. He can get off press coverage immediately. He can stack corners.
What did I do to make you question?
Because in my head, he was Scotty Miller with ball skills. And then you were like, then you pointed out he was actually like twice the size of Scotty Miller. And all of a sudden that threw everything off in my head. But
yeah,
he's got that ability to defeat press coverage, stack a corner, to really get quickly down the field and be a vertical threat. He basically fits the missing pieces of the stuff that Michael Pittman doesn't do that well necessarily. So I like that as a combination. Jelani Woods.
Can I follow up on Pierce really quick?
Sure.
Before you get in there? I mentioned this on the day two show too with Pierce. Remember a couple years ago, Frank Reich, and I probably said this about Pierce going into the draft, which is why I like the connection here. Frank Reich very specifically said when they drafted, I think it was Pittman, we're looking for receivers who make corners feel uncomfortable, basically. They have to feel something when you're getting off the line of scrimmage. Pittman makes you feel his power. Like you're intimidated by his power. You have to get your hands on him, whatever it might be. Pierce is so explosive off the line of scrimmage. He makes you feel that, right? So it makes you open your hips quicker. It makes you whatever it might be. The vertical route tree, absolutely, I think, is open for Pierce because of how quickly he gets off the line of scrimmage. So I love the fact that, like, I remember hearing Frank Reich make these comments, and when I was watching Pierce play, thinking he's making the corners feel that acceleration and speed. And that backs up what you're saying. That is completely different from Pittman. And now you're talking about a better rounded receiving core here in Indianapolis.
And it's not the best group of cornerbacks that Alabama's ever had, but he gave every single one of those guys major problems when they played in the college football playoffs. Like Alec Pierce defeated press coverage regardless of who lined up against him and was open consistently. And that, I think, is probably going to translate at the next level. So I love the Alec Pierce pick. Jelani Woods is a project at tight end, but a literally unique singular athlete. We have never seen a tight end with this collection of physical tools. He's the tight end version of Trayvon Walker, right? And actually, that's a comparison I can't believe hasn't been made more as we head towards the draft. Trayvon Walker, the number one overall pick. Jelani Woods, the tight end version of that, goes in the third round. Now, tight end is not as valuable as edge rusher, so it's not like a like-for-like thing. But we're talking about the same thing here. We're talking about a dude who literally has the perfect tight end composite, size, speed, weight, athleticism, complete picture. And he went in the third round. That is a freaking steal. And then Bernard Raimann seems like he's fallen because of knee concerns, but it's more like, do you remember Marcus McNeil? Big Chargers offensive tackle.
Out of LSU?
Was that where he's from? I don't remember.
Yep.
But he fell in the draft because he had a back condition, and it was like, that's going to curtail his career, right? He's not going to play for 15 years because this thing is going to be degenerative. It's going to limit him. But he was the best tackle in that draft for however long he did play, 5, 6, 7 years. So maybe Bernard Raimann's career is limited. There's a length of time. It's got an expiry date. But the knee is not supposed to be a hampering factor for, like, year one, year two.
You drafted him for 4 years.
That's what I'm saying. So the Colts might have found their starting tackle in the third round for a team that needs one. Like, doesn't have a left tackle. If they've achieved that and all it's cost them is maybe you don't give them the second contract or maybe you give them a shorter second contract or whatever, then that's just great business. Like, at some point, you don't care that the dude is not going to have a 15-year career.
It's an easy draft to like because we had Raimann as a first-round pick.
Yeah.
And if you just pretend it's the Colts' first-round pick.
And it's one thing.
And then Pierce in the second, Woods in the third, and also Nick Cross in the third. It's like, all right, that's a good draft too.
And there are times where, look, guys fall way beyond where we thought they should go based off injuries.
Sure.
But the injury is something that's acute. It's something that's a problem now. Raimann's injury issues are not supposed to be an acute problem. It's a lifespan problem. It's something that might be chronically an issue down the line, but it's not expected to be an issue year one. At which point, that to me, I don't care. Like
Dr. Monson has spoken.
Yeah. At that point, I don't think it should matter. Because like you said, you're drafting him for contract number one. That's contract number two's problem. That's future Mickey's issue. You know what I mean?
Future Mickey's issue. The Colts team building effort on the offensive line, right? They were number one on our offensive line rankings going into last year. They did not play as such, mostly due to injuries. But continue to have Quentin Nelson at left guard, Ryan Kelly at center, Braden Smith locked in at right tackle. 3/5 locked in. Right guard might end up being Danny Pinter, who I think is a pretty good player anyway. And it's like, all right, we're going to replace Mark Lewinsky with a bit of a question mark. But now left tackle, after Anthony Costanzo retired, you get Eric Fisher coming off of his injury. Worthwhile risk there on a short one-year deal. They were patient at finding the long-term left tackle, and then Raimann could be that guy. And you get him at pick 77. So I love that. To just go back to Woods, at 6'7", 275, with soft hands. Like, he catches the ball well.
Soft hands.
Soft hands, man. It's not clunky hands. Like, Damian Pierce, Texans running back, clunky hands. A little clunky in the pass game. Jelani Woods, straight line speed, soft hands, got to figure out route running and all that stuff. But
very
man,
small soft hands, so.
They're soft, though.
Hmm. They're soft. But for a 6'7" guy, we're small hands.
You're so obsessed with hand size sometimes.
I've got a newfound respect for it now, having actually measured mine and got a
hold on,
got
where
a
are you at again? 7.5?
8. 8 flat.
Right at 8.
Yeah.
Youth small.
Which, by the way, is absurd.
Youth large?
No, you see, this is the thing.
We're not getting into your hand size. Not getting into like my fingers are longer than my palm. We're not doing it today.
Just very quickly, right? This proves the point I've been making, which is how freaking weirdly shaped my hands are.
Mm.
Because I have shoehorned them into some very small gloves, and yet 8 flat is not. It's not abnormally like, hey, freak show over there, size, which is what I thought they were until I threw a measuring tape next to them. That's all I'm saying. Now, continue.
I shall.
Good.
The other third-round pick is Nick Cross. They're super fast. 61 on our draft board. They get him at 96. He's one of those true single-high free safeties in this draft, right? Guy that has that type of range. And I'm always fascinated by scheme changes and strategy changes and all that stuff. I do wonder, They brought in Rodney McLeod, Kyrie Willis is there, Julian Blackman's there, and they add Nick Cross. Like, they already have a ton of safeties, but Cross is a different player than all those other guys. Are the Colts eventually going to try to play more man coverage? They've been one of the most zone-heavy teams in years, but they also brought in Stephon Gilmore, mm-hmm. one of the best press man corners in the league over the last six, seven, 8 years, whatever it's been. So I wonder if there's a strategy change here at all for the Colts or a flexibility change on the defensive side of the ball. Nick Cross, more of your traditional single high free safety. Stephon Gilmore, more of your press man corner that they brought, that they just signed. So just something to keep an eye on if you're into the tactical part of football.
Yeah. And then even right down the bottom of the draft, where are we in the sixth round? Curtis Brooks, interior defensive lineman from Cincinnati, I think is a really intriguing pick, a guy that could be productive, 90-plus pass rushing grade, almost 50 pressures last season. On that defensive line, he could be a rotational guy and contribute. So I don't really understand how you hate this draft. Not you, you know, people personally.
No, I like the Colts draft, especially given what they had there. We've been talking about the receiving core for a while, and what I like is that they've brought in a whole bunch of different style playmakers. You've got different body types. If Jelani Woods hits, the payoff could be incredible. You pair him with Mo Alie-Cox. Mm-hmm. You know, you're still trying to get something out of Paris Campbell there, but, you know, he doesn't need to be a receiver one. I like where they're going here with the Colts. So, good draft.
Yeah.
So, I'd say it's a good draft by the Colts. You know who else is good is Get Sunday. It's our newest sponsor. It's Sunday.
It's actually Thursday.
No, it's Sunday.
Oh.
It's always Sunday.
Okay.
Because when your lawn has weeds, bear patches, pet spots, all that fun stuff, Sunday can help solve all these problems and more. And they do it the easy way. They've got everything you need, from fertilizer to seeds to weed control, and it's all delivered to your door. Even Steve can use this thing. Sunday can help you build a beautiful lawn or without the guesswork or the nasty chemicals. Their custom plans include fertilizer and everything you need to easily care for your lawn. You can feel good with kids or pets being around. So I know that applies to me. Ugly lawn, ton of kids, don't want the nasty chemicals, but I want it to look good. So this is perfect. Just attach the ready-to-use pouch to a garden hose and spray. It takes less than 15 minutes. It's also, yeah, it's easy for me. This is great. Sunday's offering our listeners 20% off. So full season plans will start at $129, and you can get 20% off at checkout when you visit getsunday.com/NFL pod. Getsunday.com/NFL pod. It's 20% off your custom plan at getsunday.com/NFL pod. Look, the lawns look great there on YouTube.
I'm so excited for this thing to fix my lawn.
It's 15 minutes. You just spray the thing and it's going to look good and be safe.
Pet spots, by the way, is a fantastic euphemism.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look, what we're talking about here is when the dog takes a piss on the grass. Yeah. There's a giant brown patch there now.
Spots.
This will fix it.
You need that.
I do, desperately.
Yeah.
Not so much at the front, because, you know, we don't let the dog out the front on the road. It's the back. The back is, the back's had, it's seen some things.
My kids will pee anywhere if they don't.
Yeah, okay.
On the lawn.
Perfect.
Front and back. Mm. Never know.
Well, that's the problem with having
especially when they're swimming in the pool.
Okay.
Just saying. I need Sunday. It's what I need. All right, let's go Jacksonville Jaguars next. Trayvon Walker. They went Trayvon Walker. It was all true.
Yeah.
Trayvon Walker first. The second first-round pick is Devin Lloyd. They traded up to get him. No second-round pick because of that. Luke Fortner, center out of Kentucky in the third round. Chad Muma, the linebacker out of Wyoming at pick 70 in the third round. I like Muma. Mentioned on was the Daily today, we talked our favorite and least favorite drafts. I got some questions about the Jags draft. I love Devin Lloyd, fascinated by Trayvon Walker and what he can become, but they've gone all in with him at number one overall here.
Yeah, this feels like a draft that has the same strategy to it that the Houston Texans draft had, but without any of the benefit of the doubt attached to it. You know, when you're looking at Houston's draft, you can say, okay, essentially year one of Nick Caserio taking a shot at this stuff, and he's shooting for high-end potential, top end of the range of outcomes, special. He's shooting for the home run hit. The Jags are doing the same thing, but they've been doing that for a while, and every time they take a swing at that, they seem to miss. So I think you're much less inclined to give them the benefit of the doubt of taking the chance at special than just getting good players. And that's the issue, I think, with this draft.
You've also made that point. A couple years ago, the Jags have done this a couple times now. When they drafted twice in the first round in, was it 2020, C.J. Henderson and Caleb Von Chase on.
Mm-hmm.
C.J. Henderson was similar to some of the corners in this draft where his best play was previous years before, but his overall body of work from a production standpoint wasn't great, but the size, movement skills, speed, everything was like, okay, first-round corner. And Caleb Von Chase on, to me, had five rushes where he looked like Von Miller, but he also had far fewer good rushes than any other edge defender. The potential was there, but he'd only shown flashes of it. And edge rusher is one of the positions, I will reiterate, where production matters. When you are projecting a player to the next level, production in the way we track it, pass rush win rate, pass rush grade, how often you win, how quickly you win, how well you play the run, from a production standpoint, absolutely translates very well at the next level. So 2 years ago, Caleb Von Chason and C.J. Henderson, we viewed them the same way. This is a try-to-hit-a-home-run draft with two guys who had questionable production. C.J. Henderson since been traded for a third-rounder. Caleb Von Chason, what did he grade at last year?
Not good.
He was a 47 grade last year. He's been negative war, negative 0.1 wins per season over the last 2 years.
That's not
well
great.
Below average. So it didn't work a couple years ago. Trayvon Walker's kind of along those lines. You see the flashes. You see the one of the best workouts of all time.
Yes.
For an edge defender. Size, speed, movement skills, arm length. Like, there are no weaknesses in the workout. Where you could look at Aiden Hutchinson and say, everything's great, but the arm length. Can't do that with Trayvon Walker.
I also think because of this draft, so the longer this has gone on and the more it's become apparent that the Jags were taking Trayvon Walker number one overall, the more you think that through, the more I don't agree with it, but I understand it and don't hate it. So, you know, right initially, it's like, oh, wow, the Jags are about to take Trayvon Walker. That would be crazy. Like, I cannot see the argument of taking him above Aiden Hutchinson. I still think it's a weak argument, but I have more sympathy now than I did initially in terms of, look, Walker was hamstrung by that defensive scheme in terms of putting him in a position to dominate, right? Now, does that explain all of his tape? No, because let's face it, the rest of the players on that defense weren't hamstrung as much as Trayvon Walker. So it's not like it's everything, but it does get you some of the way there to explaining why he had no college production. Two, literally never seen a player with that kind of athletic profile, right? He is built in a lab to do this. Now,
And just to add to that, just like I say, production matters at the next level. Athleticism also does matter at the next level for edge defenders historically.
Yeah, and generally you need both, right? But if you're dealing with a guy that doesn't have one, at least you can point to this and say, look, you can find a bunch of guys that were great athletes that failed. I don't know that you can find somebody that was this good an athlete that failed. So that's relevant because it is potentially unprecedented to find a guy.
You can't find a guy that's that good of an athlete that succeeded. Nobody's been this good.
Right. But the point being, like, if, you know, it's easy to look at these guys and say, well, you need to be both a good athlete and a productive player.
Yeah.
And when you see this guy who's a good athlete and not a productive player, he failed. It's like, okay, but he isn't as good an athlete as Trayvon Walker. Secondly, Aiden Hutchinson is not Nick Bosa. He's not Joey Bosa. He's not Myles Garrett. He should, I think, have been the number one pick in this draft. But we've said all along, this is a draft that basically doesn't have a bunch of top 10 players. So there's no special player at the top of this draft. And as much as Hutchinson is the cleanest prospect and the one most likely to be good, it would be great if every rush that he had didn't look the same. You know, they're all that inside counter move. It would be great if we saw a bit more of that Drake Jackson dip and bend and burst around the edge, and you didn't have the stumpy arms thing. And we were a bit more confident in what Aiden Hutchinson was to make the argument that you have to take him above Trayvon Walker. So I get why Jacksonville did it. And if that was their only risky pick, I could kind of say, all right, fair enough. But you then trade back into the first round for Devin Lloyd. And if you believe the reports that this was sort of prompted by the Quay Walker thing, that's even worse and terrible process. Even if it isn't, it's trading up for a linebacker, which tend to struggle, you know, early transitioning to the NFL these days.
I'm less worried about that part. It's more like they're still – we look at the Jets roster. So they're both bad, right? The Jets and the Jaguars. They have been the last couple of years. I feel like the Jets roster, a little bit cleaner across the board with it, either with players that we think are good or young players that could be good, right, that you're just going to give a shot to. I don't think the Jaguars are there yet. You know, they're moving forward. They made a lot of aggressive moves in free agency. Maybe they overpaid for some guys. I just don't know if the Jags are there yet. So I don't think they're in as good of a position as the Jets. It's not drastic, but they're not in as good of a position as the Jets to trade up for players. But we were also critical of the Jets for trading up. So both of those teams used their extra picks to trade up. Jaguars did it for a linebacker. Okay. I like Devin Lloyd a lot. I think he's a good player. I think linebacker has been a massive issue for the Jaguars the last couple of years.
Sure.
Now they've invested in Foye Olukun, $15 million a year. That's probably much. Athletic linebacker, but production's been up and down. So you have Olukun, you have Devin Lloyd. But again, for a roster that still needs work, you still need help across the board. At pick 70, they grab another linebacker, Chad Muma, who again is a good player, and maybe I'm contradicting myself. Always draft the best players, but Muma's the third linebacker now on the team. The investment that you have at linebacker, like you want to draft the best players, but when you just spent a first-round pick and just signed a guy for multi-year contract at $15 million per year, what's Muma's going to play 20% of the snaps? Third linebacker is not a starting position in today's NFL, and you got him at pick 70, where you still have enough other positions on the roster that need help. So that's just part of my question with the Jags draft here.
I'm just left with the lingering feeling all the time when evaluating Jacksonville's moves that there isn't a coherent strategy. There's no big picture thinking tying all of these things together. It's just acquire players and figure it out later. And sometimes I think that is a good strategy, right? Just draft a good player, figure out how he fits into your system later. This is kind of what we've praised Cincinnati for with the Daxton Hill pick, right? Just get a good player, figure out where he fits in that secondary down the line. But the difference being, A, Cincinnati has a roster good enough that you can accommodate that, right? Because they don't have a bunch of areas you need to pick off. And two, you could discern a much more coherent strategy when you look at their free agency. Like, the reason they can afford to do that with the Daxton Hill pick is because they hammered offensive line in free agency and they covered up all those cracks on the roster. Jacksonville haven't. Jacksonville did exactly the same thing in free agency, which is like, let's just throw money at people. Quick, Christian Kirk, give him the bag. Olukun, give him the bag. Like, just sign these guys. So
I don't think it's the strategy, though, Sam. The strategy is we've got holes everywhere. Let's fill them. I think it's just who they paid and who they drafted. Last year's draft was the same thing. Like, I like this player. I don't love this player. I like this player. That's how I felt, you know, with last year's draft. It was just a disconnect
there. It still feels like I don't see a pattern in anything they're doing for
like,
multiple years now.
Like, they took Muma. Muma's a good player from Wyoming, right? They took him ahead of Ryman, who went to the Colts and is going to be their starting left tackle. And, you know, maybe he's off the board because of the injuries. But you just re-signed Cam Robinson to a multi-year contract in Jacksonville, where he's never played above average football. You have right tackle Juwan Taylor, who's also been a below average player and is in the last year of his contract as well. You still need a tackle, short and long term. You know, Ryman in the third round would have been a much better pick than Muma, in my opinion, right? I mean, there were still holes on this roster where there were value plays on the board before they got their third linebacker. You know what I mean? So, hey, I wonder if the Muma pick actually signifies that they think Devin Lloyd's closer to a Micah Parsons. Remember we talked about this before the draft? There plays on tape where Devin Lloyd puts his hand in the dirt and wins off the edge, a straight pass rusher, mm-hmm. which again, to remind people, there's a difference between pass rushing and blitzing. Pass rushing is lining up as an edge and winning one-on-one. Blitzing is timing it up. Sometimes you're unblocked, you're taking on backs, whatever it is. Maybe they think Devin Lloyd is going to put his hand in the dirt on third down.
Maybe.
With all the other guys that they have, by the way, Josh Allen and Arden Key and Trayvon Walker, and maybe they think that. And Moom is going to be on the field on third down as a true linebacker with Foye Olukun. But maybe that's the strategy. But it just seemed a little questionable at the time when you see that. By the way, I wouldn't make Devin Lloyd like a 20 pass rusher game guy either. I think he's more traditional linebacker that can be a good blitzer. But I don't think he's going to do the Micah Parsons, you know, double as an edge type of deal.
I mean, his wins as a pass rusher, a true pass rusher in college, were intriguing enough that I would at least screw around with
play him. Around with it for sure. Yeah, Like, by the way,
People didn't think that Micah Parsons was going to do that. It's not like he came out and everyone was like, oh, this is this clear hybrid edge rusher linebacker kind of deal. People said the same thing. It's like, oh, he's got some pass rushes on tape, and that's kind of intriguing, but he's an off-the-ball linebacker. And then it was only when Dallas like ran out of bodies on the defensive line, they were like, let's put this freak athlete there and see what happens. And it turns out he's Lawrence Taylor. Like, that's what changed the whole dynamic there. So Jacksonville probably in the same position with Devin Lloyd of he's our off-the-ball linebacker. But now, having seen what Micah Parsons did, I would at least give him the ability to show some of that. Like, let's see what it looks like. And maybe it's nothing. Maybe there's nothing there, right? Maybe he's just a linebacker that was dominant in college because he's a great athlete. But at the next level, it's not going to work. But let's find out.
Like I said on the comp show, what I wanted Akeem Ayers to be almost 10 years ago. Yeah. Akeem Ayers put his hand in the dirt at UCLA and actually rushed the passer well. You know, Brandon Spikes in his 5-flat 40 put his hand in the dirt and rushed the passer in college. Right? There were a lot of guys historically who were linebackers who rushed off the edge, had some success in college, but never did it at the NFL level. So, hey, I'm intrigued by that. I like Lloyd. I can't wait to watch Trayvon Walker and his development. Luke Fortner might be able to compete at center, so they at least got an offensive lineman there. You got Muma in the third. No real picks that stood out. We ranked a couple below average picks in rounds 5 and 6, PFF, Snoop Connor and Gregory Jr. And Monteric Brown, we had gave a good pick selection, the corner out of Arkansas at pick 222 in round 7. But this draft, obviously Trayvon Walker is the story. But also Devin Lloyd, right, in justifying the trade-up and having him play well in the first round. I'm just saying, recent trade-ups for linebackers, you have Devin Bush not having his fifth-year option picked up. You have Kenneth Walker, hasn't been great for the Chargers. It's just a risky proposition to not only trade up, but trade up for linebackers in the first round, what we've seen recently. So.
Mm-hmm.
Sound good?
Average draft.
Oh, yeah. Where did they rank the Jags? 24th was the consensus. PFF goes C+ here.
Yeah, I gave him a C.
In part because, yeah, we would have done something different at the top. But I think you've done a good job of laying out the fair points that the Jaguars would be considering for Trayvon Walker over Aiden Hutchinson, even if we wouldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's wrap up the AFC South.
With who?
The Tennessee Titans. Oh, you didn't tell me I got this curl off to the side. Stray. You gotta tell me when the stray curls happen in here.
I mean, my interest in the status of
I'll let you know if you've got hair out of place.
Yeah, I'm just saying my interest in the status of other people's haircuts has diminished pretty severely.
Don't be
over
so fair.
The last few months.
Tennessee Titans. Where did they rank on the rankings here? 11th.
What?
B+.
How?
Did anyone factor in the AJ Brown? That wasn't a pick. They probably just said they had a first-round pick and they took Treylon Burks with that first-round pick.
I gave this draft a C.
Because you don't – I know what you're going to get into as far as that strategy. So they trade A.J. Brown for a first-round pick that becomes Treylon Burks at 18. They come back at pick 35 with Roger McCreary, the short-armed corner out of Auburn. Nicholas Petit-Frere out of Ohio State, pick 69 in round 3. We had him 120 on our board. And then Malik Willis. That's why people –
yeah, you're right.
Malik Willis, round 3, pick 86, number 30 on the PFF draft board. Interesting draft here. And
yes.
One where if they didn't lose A.J. Brown, well, they wouldn't have pick 18, but...
Correct. So, start with that.
Start with the Treylon Burks discussion,
yes.
Right?
You have to start with that. If we're factoring in the A.J. Brown trade for Philadelphia, you have to factor it in reverse for Tennessee, which means you come to the conclusion they got worse at wide receiver. Because now... Treylon Burks has to step in and become A.J. Brown right from the get-go in order for them to just stay level.
But you're saving the money.
Yes. So that's the gamble, right? You are trading that money, the 4 years, $100 million contract, for the gamble that Treylon Burks can step in and be the same guy that A.J. Brown was. Now, to be fair, Burks has that kind of physical potential. 6'2", 225. Okay, didn't run great, but ran well enough, ran in the A.J. Brown ballpark, and it's not like A.J. Brown's been suffering for speed at the next level. He has the capacity to do that. It's just we know that the chances of that happening are not great. Unlike A.J. Brown, he's also had a college role and deployment that is very far divergent from anything he's going to be doing in the NFL. Arkansas used him as – an athlete, as a designated athlete. It's like, that is the dude. That's the best playmaker we have. Let's write down all the ways we can get the ball in his hands without him having to do anything difficult in terms of being a wide receiver, right? To get the ball in A.J. Brown's hands, that guy has to first run a route, get open, and then catch the ball from Ryan Tannehill. So we're just going to, like, to get the ball in Treylon Burks' hands, we're going to line him up at tight end, we're going to line him up in the backfield, we're going to, however we do it, we're just going to get him free catches and then let him make plays. And he did that great, and Arkansas did that great, but the NFL isn't doing that, right? The NFL, A, is bad at that. We've talked about this before for anybody that's a gimmick type of player. The NFL stinks at creating that role for players, and it's not all their fault. Like, it's the field dimensions with the hash marks, et cetera, make it more difficult, but the point being, Treylon Burks is going to have to learn how to play wide receiver if he wants to have the same kind of impact as A.J. Brown. And he hasn't done that before. So it's almost certainly a fairly significant downgrade with the first move that they made.
So Treylon Burks, and you've compared it to the Vikings before with, you know, Justin Jefferson directly replacing Stephon Diggs on the cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And that's awesome. I think a big part of the strategy is, I can't wait for this NFL season. My biggest story this NFL season is the teams that have acquired wide receiver one this offseason and the teams that have lost wide receiver one this offseason. And my feeling is I am team shiny object. I am team wide receiver one. I think that's the guy. I think when we've ranked historically what the most valuable thing is, remember when we ranked QBs and head coaches? Like, how many QBs are you going to take before you take the first head coach? And we said maybe it's eight quarterbacks before you decide Andy Reid or Bill Belichick or John Harbaugh or whoever you think the best head coach is, Sean McVay. You take eight quarterbacks before you take the first head coach. I think there's a legit debate. Where does wide receiver one fit into this equation in today's NFL? How many quarterbacks do you take before a Devontae Adams, a Tyreek Hill, maybe an A.J. Brown, prime Julio Jones, prime Antonio Brown, where do they fit in? Are they 10th, 15th, whatever it might be on the list? But I think we're going to learn a lot about that position this year.
Sure.
And I am absolutely fascinated by the teams that have, and this is playoff teams, a lot of playoff teams, the Chiefs, the Packers, now the Titans, number one seed, have moved on from wide receiver one and say, we're not paying that guy. And instead, for $25 million per year, we're going to deploy our resources elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And now, but when I look at the Titans roster and I say, okay, where are they deploying these resources? What has come before this that they had to make this decision for A.J. Brown? You know, I mean, listeners know we don't love their edge rushers, right? They know we don't love the fact that they're paying Bud Dupree 16-plus and Harold Landry 17-plus. In 2023, they're going to pay those guys over $33 million for edge rusher. A valuable position, but $33 million when I think A.J. Brown could actually be the reason why Ryan Tannehill completely rejuvenated his career.
Right.
And it's being masked as maybe it's Derrick Henry, it's the new system, and it's the new world, when it might just be A.J. Brown, wide receiver one, everything else gets better because of that guy.
And this, like, that is all it's like the Saints discussion again. That's more of a roster construction, deployment of resources, overall cost-benefit analysis. For grading their draft, it's like, well, they took a $100 million gamble that Treylon Burks can replace A.J. Brown right away. Almost certainly not going to happen. It's going to be a downgrade. So the first pick they made, you can't give a particularly good grade to. Even if you think Treylon Burks has high upside, I think he does. He was a very, very difficult evaluation because of the negatives I talked about, which is the dude hasn't played wide receiver. He's played athlete, and that's immediately hard to project to the next level, even for a great athlete. And then he wasn't as good an athlete as people thought he was when he went through the testing. So I like Treylon. I'm really fascinated to see how he develops because I loved his tape initially. And then the more you dove into it and the more you thought about it, the more reservations you had. But I love what he can become. And now he has obviously a path, not just to the field, but to be like alpha in that offense. So,
I mean,
all for that in concept. Just when you factor in, they traded away A.J. Brown to make it happen. You can't love the pick.
Are they going to, from a team building effort though, because they got Robert Woods for a late round draft pick, right? He's got over $16 million average per year too.
Right.
That's $9 million less than AJ Brown. Are they going to view this as, well, we got for AJ Brown, and instead of having AJ Brown, we have the money to pay Robert Woods over the next couple of years, and we have a Treylon Burks, and that's the better play.
Yeah.
Right. Again, even though they went into the draft with Robert Woods and AJ Brown,
right,
they probably said, hey, we can't pay AJ $25 million a year and Robert Woods $16 million a year. So now it's Woods plus Burks. And again, I am Mr. like, get to four awesome pass catchers as fast as possible. Is that the better play? Treylon Burks and Robert Woods, is that the better play for the Titans? Because that's kind of what we're weighing here.
Maybe, but it's not the better play for their draft grade.
I'm trying to talk about the holistic approach here by the Titans.
First pick, don't love. Second pick, Roger McCreary.
Stop
second
keeping
round.
Me on point here about
high
just
second
the draft.
Round.
I'm surprised McCreary. Are you surprised McCreary went this high?
Yes.
I started convincing myself he was going round three or four.
Yeah, maybe not that low, but I definitely top of the second felt like a stretch. Bottom of the second made some more sense. McCreary, so, has really good tape, has really good PFF grades, really good production grades in a tough conference for an extended period of time. And as I say, you go back to 2019, you can find a tape of him giving Ja'Marr Chase everything Ja'Marr Chase could handle. Like, he went one-on-one with that dude a couple of years ago and held his own in a year where Ja'Marr Chase was blowtorching the college football landscape. 2 years before, he went in and blowtorched the NFL landscape. So that's as good as it gets. And that was a couple of years earlier in McCreary's development. So that on its own, I think, is a pretty significant data point backing him up. But number one, absurdly short arms, like under 30 inches. Me and Roger McCreary are the same height, and my arms are 3 inches longer, right? That's weird. That's not supposed to happen.
You might be higher on some boards.
I mean, look,
because he's crossed off some boards.
The more measurables we get on me, the more of an intriguing athletic profile I build, right? It's not necessarily a good one, but it's very interesting. I'm just saying, McCreary, it's sixth percentile for any corner, right? That's factoring in guys like Marcus Jones with his 5'8" height. You know what I mean? That's just abnormal. It's not right. And that does cause him problems. You find a lot of plays where at the catch point, he's just dealing with like 6 inches less in reach. He can't make the play. And then the more you dive into his tape, the more you realize that there is a reason this dude has been so heavily targeted throughout his college career, right? And that, we sort of euphemistically refer to that as battle test.
Battle test, right? I like that, yeah.
Dude's seen a lot, right? He's been through some wars.
He used that for Jeff Gladney in the Big 12.
Right, exactly. And that didn't work out great. Now, that didn't work out great for a couple of reasons, but even on the field, it wasn't looking great. But McCreary, like, that guy's seen a lot of targets because he gives up some plays. And teams consistently went after the dude. So, usually when you're taking a guy at the top of the second round, it's because you think he has elite tools and ability and can pan out and blah, blah. McCreary, I just don't see that. I think you are probably going to be limited to a capable starting kind of player if he can overcome the stumpy little arms. And that just feels like it's a reach at that point.
I like McCreary overall, though. That was my Steven Nelson comp, right? You know, he's going to be in the ballpark. You know, some years it's going to go his way. Some years he might get torched. I don't mind the group of corners that they're accumulating here, though, in Tennessee, because still have Christian Fulton, who broke out, had a nice season last year. Caleb Farley, last year's first-round risk, you know, didn't see the field a ton and still is a risk, you know, because mm-hmm. Wasn't great even when he was out there. You know my love for Elijah Molden in the slot. I think Roger McCreary is going to compete with him probably for slot snaps initially and some flexibility there. So maybe it's a little high for McCreary, but I like what Tennessee's doing as far as taking a whole bunch of shots at the secondary there. Petit Frere took over at tackle for Ohio State. Maybe he comes in and competes at right tackle. They might want to have him right at right tackle with Dylan Raduns. Last year's second rounder, you know, staying at guard. Raduns bounced back and forth between guard and tackle. So there's some offensive line depth there. And then there's the Malik Willis question. And we're not gonna get into the Tannehill comments. I just tweeted, it is absurd. I can't believe people are even talking about these Tannehill comments that quarterbacks make all the time when we're still reviewing the NFL draft. It's not June or July. It's not like Tom Brady's not top five quarterback season where, you know, Sam's going on ESPN and we have nothing to talk about and you're going viral, right? Like, the draft just happened and Tannehill just has a normal comment. But
it might be normal. I think it's clumsy, though. I mean, it's just, you can say better things. You can. It's a bad answer.
That's the best take. That's the most nuanced take you've had that anyone's had. You could say better things. Doesn't mean he hates him. Doesn't mean he's afraid of his job. Just means his job's the Titans. Quarterback. That's his job. His job's to be good for the Titans at $30 million a year. That's his job. And if along the way Malik Willis needs help, I'm sure he's going to help him, but it's not his job. So Tannehill's got two more years on his contract. When do we see Malik Willis?
So Malik Willis is the key to this draft in terms of grade, in terms of how this draft is perceived, in terms of how successful it is going down the line. And because he was most people's QB1, a guy that was potentially going to be a top 10 player in this draft in terms of Seattle could have taken him at 9, getting him a pick number 86 in the third round, like some of the best value in the draft, therefore best draft. The problem I have with it is, so I agree with that. First and foremost, right? It is great value. Even if you go strictly by like big board ranking, right? That he's not a first round caliber player, or if he is, it's fringe. And PFF's big board, he was the 30th best player in the draft. Even by that standards, 30 versus 86, it's fantastic value. The problem I have with it is when we were evaluating Malik Willis as an NFL quarterback, the idea was, he brings a very high floor to the table because of his rushing ability, because of what he can do on the ground with his legs, in a similar vein to Jalen Hurts, who's not a great passing quarterback right now, but the Eagles are top 10 in EPA per play because Jalen Hurts rushes for like 800 yards and a bunch of touchdowns. Malik Willis, I think, brings a similarly high floor because of that rushing skill, which is freaky. Like, his ability to break tackles, to run, is crazy. And his arm is absurd. But the same problems as Jalen Hurts in terms of limits as a passer. Jalen Hurts is probably actually a better passer overall. Malik Willis has a better arm, but I think Jalen Hurts is a more complete quarterback right now. So when you're thinking about what he is at the NFL level or what he can bring to the table, it does require you adjusting what you do in terms of offense to match what he does, right? There's no point doing the Michael Vick thing and saying, we run the West Coast offense, so you're going to be a West Coast quarterback that has an occasional bootleg, you know? That's the answer. You can't do that with Malik Willis. If you're going to start him at quarterback, he needs to have a system that actually plays to what he does. When you take him in the third round, that's off the table now. You're not doing what the Ravens did for Lamar Jackson, which is Joe Flacco started for a while, but off in the back room, they were building this offense for Lamar Jackson from the ground up. Like, Greg Roman was out here going through the thing play by play and tossing out stuff that made no sense for Lamar Jackson and figuring out what did make sense and then like multiplying those plays. They were building the Lamar Jackson offense in the Skunk Works and the basement of that Baltimore Ravens facility so that when Lamar Jackson became starter, boom, whole offense built around him. You're not doing that for Malik Willis in the third round. It's just not going to happen. He's going to be thrown in there and said, this is our offense, learn how to do it. And if you're good at it, you get a shot. If he never gets, or if he's not great at that, because he is, you know, limited to a, if you're going to need to build an offense around him for him to be good, this pick almost certainly has, it doesn't pan out.
What needs to happen to build that offense, though? Because when you're talking about just stitching a quarterback run, as a starting point, stitching the quarterback run game, I mean, it's still the same concepts. We're going to run outside zone, we're going to run power, we're going to run counter, except there's a quarterback in the gun, and he might keep it. Right? I mean, that's the starting point for Malik Willis. Now, if you're talking, here are the pass concepts that fit him versus Ryan Tannehill. Yeah, every quarterback's going to be different in that respect. Right,
but the lower down, the less investment you have in the guy, the less you're inclined to actually do anything to change it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Malik Willis is challenging for the starting job until next year. So this year happens, I don't think the Titans are going to win the Super Bowl. Just saying. I don't think – my prediction is the Titans aren't going to win the Super Bowl.
They were the number one seed in the AFC last year.
The odds are against them. Odds are against every team right now. Mm-hmm. So the Titans end the season They're in the playoffs. They lose in the playoffs. There's something disappointing. Something happens. A year from now, we're probably debating this thing. Assuming Tannehill stays healthy this year. All right, now it's Tannehill's last year of his contract. Now is it Malik Willis versus Ryan Tannehill? And that's when the Tennessee Titans can make that decision. Do we have our handcrafted offense for Malik Willis? Because they'll have a year of practice. So this might work well for him, right? Because his weakness is certainly the pass game. And if he's learning a different offense and he's got a year to maybe make his turn his weaknesses, not into strengths, but just improve upon his weaknesses within the current Tennessee Titans offense, then a year from now, we're thinking, okay, when's he taking over? When is he going to take over? Is he not? I think during the season, the Malik Willis package can be a thing. Everything we asked for Trey Lance. Get him and Derrick Henry on the field at the same time. Absolutely.
I think we're still – because of where people thought Malik Willis was going to be drafted, it is still coloring the reality of where Malik Willis was drafted and therefore what he is, right? Malik Willis to the NFL, as Desmond Ridder to the NFL, as all these quarterbacks are now Kellen Mond, right? Which is – a dude that was drafted in the third round, for the first time, the Minnesota Vikings taking a look and thinking, well, maybe Kirk Cousins should have some kind of nod to the idea that his job might not be 100% safe, right? Instead of Sean Mannion sitting behind you, we just drafted a guy in the third round. You need to at least think about what happens if you stink, right? So they draft Kellen Mond. Kellen Mond then has, but they then do nothing to like help Kellen Mond succeed. Right? We drafted you. You're the backup quarterback, or you're just another quarterback on this roster. Now show that you can like unseat or put pressure on Kirk Cousins. We will do nothing to assist you on that. Just show us. That's what Malik Willis is now. They have drafted him. He's a second quarterback behind Ryan Tannehill. The dude has nothing, like no support structure beyond the ordinary support structure of a backup quarterback. So
you think our perception of Kellen Mond is like, yeah, that's when you take him, third, fourth round, fine.
Yes.
Our perception of Malik Willis is, wow, what a steal. You got him in the third round.
Right.
Here's a first-round caliber player. Do something for him. And you're telling me it's the same thing. Malik Willis.
So they're not doing anything for him now. He's been brought in. It's a roll of the dice. And they'll see if he can put pressure on Ryan Tannehill by being better than they expect him to be as a third-round quarterback. If he can't, they're not boosting him up, right? They're not going away and saying, well, right now he's not putting a ton of pressure on Tannehill, but what if we created this offense for him that actually played into his strengths? They're not doing that for a third-round pick. They're going to give him a shot, and if he doesn't take it, he's not taking it.
I think they're also going to see how fast and good of a runner he is and that they want to put him on the field at times this year because he's on the football team and they want to make the football team better. Which isn't grooming him to be the next guy, but it's like... I think Malik Willis and Derrick Henry on the field at the same time would be a little scary.
Is the Brandon Graham bet still alive? Or are you finally tapping out on that?
No, that does not auto-renew.
I mean, the people said it did. So if you want it to stop, you should probably say so right now.
Why are you asking?
Well, answer the question first.
It's dead. Did he just retire or something?
No. So Brandon Graham is dead. I will bet you instead.
Brandon Graham is not dead. The bet is dead. Please don't.
I didn't say that. I said the Brandon Graham bet is dead.
Okay.
I will replace the Brandon Graham bet, which is he gets double-digit sacks or not, then he won't, with a Malik Willis playing time bet.
Okay.
So absent of injury, given
right.
him starts.
Of course.
Give me an over-under in snaps for Malik Willis year one.
So is this non-garbage time too?
Yes. Just package, the Malik Willis package that you seem to think will happen. Give me an over-under on snaps for that.
40.
Under. Hammer the under. I will bet you the lunch for that.
3 per game.
Uh-huh. Under. Hammer it. Bet?
Yeah, what's Alabama's? You want to go to Alabama's today?
No, but that can be
got
the lunch.
Got some cash. I can go there.
Under, yes?
I'm going to go there
bet?
After. Yeah.
Good.
Let's do a little fish fry.
40 snaps.
Here.
Somebody write that down. 40 snaps. For the Malik Willis package.
Somebody write that down. Including the playoffs?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Malik Willis package. Let me text somebody from the Titans just to confirm that this might be. Give me a minute here before we solidify this. Let me just send some feelers out.
Nope, can't have it.
Get Vrabel on the horn here. All right, we've remembered the Titans. They also got Kyle Phillips. Really good slot receiver to compete with the other slot receiver, Treylon Burks.
Mm-hmm.
who they're probably going to play on the outside. Titans draft, you didn't love it overall.
Well, because of that, right? I think people are giving it people are giving that Malik Willis pick like an A+, steal the draft, blah blah blah. I think because he slid that far, a lot of the benefit of what you gain in Malik Willis in terms of being able to craft a system around him, actually give him a shot to be really good, I think that evaporates and he becomes just this roll of the dice toolsy quarterback in the third round, which is fine. But it, like the pick,
which I love. I mean, that's a great part of the draft,
right? But the pick at that point doesn't become any better than like a standard toolsy quarterback picked in the third round. Just because we thought he was better than that, I don't think you can necessarily give him that much credit for it. I don't like the first round pick because I think you're just trying to hit that tiny target that the Vikings hit. I don't love the second round pick because I think it was a reach. So I, at this point, I haven't loved their draft so far. Right now, they I think then added a few players later on that I think are better, but. Overall, this is not a great draft to me.
Given the AFC South, a lot of love here today. Let's move to the AFC West and the Denver Broncos, number 16, dead smack in the middle in the consensus rankings. B+ from PFF, D+ from Thor. That's the only thing below. Yeah, the only thing in the D's or F's. No, sorry, there's a D from no, that was someone else. Yeah, D+ from Thor. Any thoughts on the Broncos? Of course, no first-round pick due to the Russell Wilson trade. But we don't factor that into the grades. We just have to mention that's why they didn't have a first-round pick. Their actual first pick, Nick Benito, at number 64, Oklahoma edge rusher, 38 on the PFF draft board. Greg Dulcich, the tight end out of UCLA, they get him at number 80 in round 3. Damari Mathis, the cornerback out of Pittsburgh, you get in round 4 at pick 115. I think those are solid top 3 picks there for the Broncos.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty decent draft. I really like Nick Benito generally. I think he's been underrated in this draft process. He's been labeled fairly, I think, as a designated pass rusher, right, at the next level. But I think people are underrating what that is now. Like, a designated pass rusher used to be a dude that would only play on 3rd and 7 or longer. A designated pass rusher in today's NFL can be on the field half the time. Like, the obvious passing plays are like 40% of the NFL at this point. So if Nick Benito is only a designated pass rusher, he can still play 40% of your defensive snaps and be as good a pass rusher as you have. That's really good to get at 64 overall.
No, I like that a lot. My concern, Benito's production is exceptional. So you guys have heard me talk about edge production and defensive line production, and it translates, and that's what you should bank on. But you do have to pair it with measurables. And he's a guy that was listed at 238 from Oklahoma until he went to the combine. I think it was 248 that he weighed in at. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't feel like his playing weight. So he's probably a guy that's at 240. And you don't have this history of exceptional rushers at 240. And Benito doesn't always show the power. And that is one thing as a pass rusher. It's what's interesting about receivers, right? Like, if receivers only have one or two things that they do well, you have an offense that can maximize that, right? Do this thing well. Yards after the catch, downfield ability, speed, whatever it is. Do this thing well. As an edge rusher, you do need to win in multiple ways. Because if you don't have power, our friend Joe Thomas and Andrew Whitworth, the guys that we have on here that are so smart, they're like, I don't have to worry about your power. Okay, I eliminate 1/3 essentially of what you can do. That makes my life easier.
Yeah.
So he doesn't have the power. He wins with speed and burst. It worked really well at the college level. Will it translate? But all of those questions, like at 64...
Yeah.
I will take that at 64, absolutely.
But one thing that he does have, so I agree, he doesn't play with a ton of power, but he does play with more than one way of winning with speed and quickness, which is important. He isn't just, so when you look at Drake Jackson, almost every one of his, and Aiden Hutchinson as well, every one of their rushes are the same, like the ones they win, Drake, and they're opposite. Drake Jackson's, every one of his rushes are that Robert Quinn bend and dip around the edge, generally speaking, that speed burst around the corner. Great. Aiden Hutchinson, almost every single one of his rushes is that inside counter move, right? You threaten the outside and then you bounce back inside and drive into that gap. Nick Benito wins with both of them. So he might never convert into a bull rush and drive you back anywhere, but he will threaten your outside shoulder. And then if you overcommit to that, he can jump back inside and knife through that gap that you opened up. And that's very Von Miller-like. I'm not saying he's Von Miller. But that's, if you think of Von Miller, some of his best pass rushes are that freakish inside counter move where he's able to like jump laterally like a yard and a half inside at the point where the tackle has just opened his hips out and his set and has turned too far. And then, voomf, Von Miller does that like swerve thing inside and he's way too quick for you to deal with that. Benito has the same thing. And that's why his pass rush win rate is through the freaking roof, right? It's 29%.
It's legit, yeah.
Which is, you can't do that if you're only winning in one way. So he wins in a couple of different ways, but it's all with speed and quickness. And the same thing in the run game. Like, he's probably a better run defender than people give him credit for because he's winning with that penetration and knifing pass blockers. And it's only if you get him head on that he's toast. But again, like that, I think is more important than people are giving it credit for. Like if you're consistently beating people to a spot, you're going to cause problems, even if once they get their hands on you, you're done.
I love the way he's fun to watch in the run game, the way he wins. But the way he wins with quick, like running around blocks.
Yes.
That's I call that Schoberting. Joe Schobert.
Yeah, but on the other hand,
because that's how he won as an edge at Wisconsin, an undersized edge that has become a middle linebacker at the NFL.
Right.
Level.
And it, yes. So it's again, it's a spectrum of things, right? It can either go the Joe Schobert route, which is that's fine when you win, but when you don't win, it's a problem. Or it can become the Von Miller route, which is that dude is constantly in the backfield at all times. And you can't, like, he's, Von Miller is one of the best run defenders in the NFL, and you typically don't find him winning by stacking and shedding. You find him winning by doing what Joe Schobert and Nick Benito do, which is get the hell around blocks. Because he's too quick, he's too fast, he's too bendy, and you can't block him, right? That's your spectrum. Now, where does Nick Benito fall on that? Probably in the middle, right? Is that fair?
Yeah.
He's not going to be Von Miller, and he's probably not going to be Joe Schobert. But that's the spectrum you're talking about here. So
he's also going to be, right now, the number three rusher with Bradley Chubb there and now Randy Gregory. And that, yeah, also I love.
But he's almost certainly immediately a better pass rusher than Bradley Chubb.
I think that's fair, too. Chubb's should be a better all-around
which
player.
Which immediately, like, complements, right? Because now all of a sudden, now you got Randy Gregory, who's like your alpha edge rusher, and now you have a platoon of designated pass rusher and run specialist of Bradley Chubb for the first, you know, however, like, now you have a rotation that makes sense.
So Benito did weigh in at 248. I just want to highlight really quick, because I love him. His grades are great. My concern is the size and the power, and can he be that every down player, but is he still good enough too, even as a pass rusher? Since 2012, up to 240-pound edge rushers. You have Robert Mathis. He won for years at that level. 91 pass rush.
245?
No, he was below that. This is from combine measurables here.
Yeah, but then he became bigger in the NFL. Yeah,
Chris Clemens
listed at 245.
Yeah, I mean, I'm listed at 260.
Okay.
I'm not 260, but you know, it's what the card says. Dennis the Barbarian Gardeck.
The Barbarian.
84 pass rush grade.
That's the greatest tweet that anybody has ever sent.
The Barbarian.
Year. That dude's agent needs a raise for that alone.
He's got 94 snaps in his career, but an 84 pass rush grade. The Barbarian. Hassan Reddick, another guy that did get moved to linebacker, but when he got moved to edge, technically he's a little undersized. Andrew Van Ginkle has been very productive for the Dolphins, 78 pass rush grade. Why are there two? Oh, these are by season. That's why. I get the season filter on. That's why I'm like, why is Robert Mathis on this thing again? Arden Key was listed as lower too, but he's bulked up. Josh Uche is another maybe proxy for the Patriots, a guy that was uber productive and slightly undersized.
Anyway,
there's not a ton.
What do you think Arden Key weighs now? Because he looked bigger for the 49ers.
270? 265?
270?
265?
Come on.
His legs are thick.
He's not 270. You think he put on 35 pounds?
He looks huge. Who was the guy that was at Michigan's? Shalique Calhoun.
Yeah.
Made that move, too.
Right.
Let me ask Bobby.
That didn't work out. Yeah, Bobby must know what he weighs.
How much does Arden weigh? All right, talk about the Broncos draft while I text Bobby.
So look,
figure out why they drafted a running
back. I love
the
Nick Benito pick. I think people are unfairly focusing on the negative side of Nick Benito's game. And I think the positive side is bigger than people are giving it credit for. So to get that at the bottom of the second round, bottom of the second round at pick number 64, phenomenal value to me. Greg Dulcich, tight end from UCLA. That's a weird one because, you know, they have Albert O there. They trade away Noah Fant. They've got a bevy of weapons for Russell Wilson everywhere else. Russell Wilson doesn't use the tight end a hell of a lot generally. You like the potential that Dulcich brings. It's just difficult to see exactly how much of a role he's going to have in that offense and therefore what that value is. But hell, third round.
Is this a HIPAA violation?
No.
If Bobby gave me Arden's
guy's weight? Yeah. How's that a medical thing?
They probably have team weigh-ins every week and all that stuff. They could probably find it.
It's not like a medical issue. It's just how much does the dude weigh?
I mean, it can be. It depends on how much you weigh.
What?
I don't know. Could be.
Shut up. It's not a HIPAA violation. What are you talking about? I'm just telling you to shut up. It's ridiculous.
Barkevious Mingo has the most snaps for an under 240-pounder.
That didn't work out great.
Since 2012.
Damari Mathis. This is an okay draft.
Mathis had one of the best reps I've ever seen at the Senior Bowl.
Best reps.
Much like Deion Jones had one of the best reps I've ever seen at the Senior Bowl. So do with that what you want. But I was watching Tariq Woolen, watching his reps. He was on one side, and I didn't know where Woolen was at the beginning of the play. And I look up, and Mathis absolutely wrecked the receiver at the line of scrimmage in press. And Mathis at Pitt, those guys played more press coverage than any other team. So he had some of the most press coverage snaps in anybody in the NFL. So there's some experience there with Mathis. I don't think he's not a great player, but that one rep was like, wow, this dude knows how to play press. So there is at least that as far as flexibility within the scheme there at the next level.
Okay.
Where'd the Broncos land in the rankings here? I think people kind of – oh, yeah, I said that. 16, B-plus grade. I think Benito –
slap bang in the middle.
Yeah, Benito looks good. Dulcich had some big plays at UCLA. He's a little undersized. He is more of that H-backy size, I guess, at tight end and not that every down type of player.
Yeah, I mean, if they didn't have Albert O already, it would be, I think, a better pick, or at least you would see how he would contribute more and have a bigger impact. But because he's already there, it's a good pick. It's just tough to see how excited you can get about it.
A bunch of depth added on day three. No particular picks and players that I loved there necessarily. Yeah. But
agreed.
Spent a lot of time on Benito. I think that's where the draft is. Do you want to spend any time on Russell Wilson? That was their first round pick.
No, because it happened before. A long time before. It doesn't count.
The rules say
yep.
We can't discuss any further. So who's after Denver? Kansas City. This is the best draft. Kansas City Chiefs up next. They had the PFF draft board handy, did they not?
I mean, it does seem that way, yeah. Was it every pick they made? Every one but one, right? The Brian Cook pick, I think, was the one where we didn't have a significant edge in their favor in terms of the PFF big board.
Yeah, it was close. It was close.
Trent McDuffie. They
trade up to get Trent McDuffie
at 21. Number 11 player on PFF's big board. George Karlaftis, 10th overall player on the big board. Get him at 30. So first round, obviously, PFF absolutely loves. You get these two guys. And so we talked about the pattern that the Texans have of shooting for the high end potential. This is almost the opposite pattern of let's just take the really good player, even though there are not concerns, but even though they don't necessarily tick all the boxes.
Right? Yeah.
They tick enough that we're happy at pick number 21 that we traded up to get and pick number 30. Like Karlaftis at 30 is a freaking steal. It's insane how much value that is. When we're focusing on about the first three guys, Trayvon Walker, Kayvon Thibodeau, Aiden Hutchinson, the next group became, Jermaine Johnson is maybe heading into that direction, but then we're into the Boye Mafe, Arnold Ebiketie, those are the guys we're all fascinated by. What the hell happened to George Karlaftis, who has better tape than basically everybody except Hutchinson, maybe Thibodeau? That dude is really good, is a wrecking machine, just constantly causes problems. And because he doesn't have anything necessarily special about his game, that he just completely flew under the radar. Nobody cared.
4.78 split at 40. 48th percentile.
Yeah.
1.65 10-yard split, 56th percentile.
Uh-huh.
I mean, those are a couple. Vertical was really good. Broad was good. But he's more of a power player.
Yeah.
But I really think when you talk about ticking boxes as an edge, the arm length is right in the middle as well. Even for a power player, 53rd percentile, 33-plus inch arms. The 10-yard split is something that teams really look at from a tape standpoint and from a numeric standpoint. But from a tape standpoint, Karlaftis doesn't really challenge the edge a whole lot, right? He doesn't put the tackle in a bind where the tackle has to rush his pass sets, right? I always use that for Boye Mafe. It felt like tackles have to be set, right? They have to get to their drop quickly, because he'll be there faster than them. Karlaftis doesn't do that. So, I mean, those are the things when you're putting from a scouting standpoint that they're factoring in. Can he do this? Can he do that? Can he do this? Can he do that? Where, again, we're looking at this more from how often did he win standpoint. And splitting those up. How often did he win last year? Very often. He was awesome.
He reminds me so much of Brandon Graham. And actually, when you look at the – when you fire up the PFF IQ player comparator and look at them side by side, they're very similar in a lot of ways. Brandon Graham had relatively short arms. Carl Aftis is a little bit longer. They have almost –
I appreciate you using the comparator. That's great. It's a great tool.
Almost the same 40-yard time. Brandon Graham was a 4.7 guy. Carl Aftis a 4.78. The 10-yard split is literally the same, 1.65 for each guy. Graham had more reps on the bench. Carl Aftis a little bit better vertical. Broad jump was a little bit better for Carl Aftis. Short shuttle a tiny bit better for Brandon Graham. They're very similar in prospects. And I think the other thing that makes me compare the two is I think they're both similarly underrated. I mean, the reason the Brandon Graham bet exists in the first place is because Graham never got the sack total that he should for the amount of pressure the guy generates. Like, he causes all kinds of problems for opposing offenses and quarterbacks, but it never converted to sacks. And generally, that doesn't consistently happen. You know, usually if you generate that volume of pressure, the sacks come somewhere down the line. Never did for Graham. And because of that, I think the guy took a long time for him to get the kind of recognition that he deserved, even as a former first-round pick, which is very rare. Usually, if you're a first-round pick, you're just seen as a really good player automatically until you, like, prove otherwise. Graham was always generated pressure in different schemes, different systems, didn't get the sacks, so he never got the recognition. Carl Aftis feels like a similar player in terms of we are just overlooking and underrating this guy because there are some limitations to his game or some lack of special when it comes to athleticism, but he's going to be productive. He's going to be disruptive. He's going to cause problems. For the Chiefs, who have been like waiting for Frank Clark to finally show something and justify the salary, Carl Aftis is going to come in day one and provide the kind of impact that Frank Clark has never given them.
Does Carl Aftis take over the Brandon Graham trade? Is that auto-renew too? You made a player comp, so we got to expect 10 sacks from him.
No, we'll see how year one goes, and then maybe spool it up next year.
Yeah, my notes kind of matched, I think, what the 10 times says, right? He's power, average burst, stone hands to rock offensive linemen. He wins with power, right? He wins with contact, first contact on the lineman with power. This is why we were a little critical of the Frank Clark trade at the time, because in the late first, can you get this type of player?
Right.
I thought Frank Clark's history in Seattle should have made him he should have played better in Kansas City, because he did grade well in Seattle, just not great.
Mm-hmm.
But either way, we've got some depth here. And I mean, I assume Frank Clark's still going to be on the roster this year. Carl Aftis, Frank Clark, Chris Jones up front now, much better, right? In a major weakness for Kansas City. So I like that move quite a bit. Sky Moore, they get in the second round, a guy that we had top 22. On our draft board, number 5 wide receiver.
Gotta love that.
And now the diversification of this Chiefs wide receiver core. You have a huge Marquez Valdes-Scantling as a deep threat. You have a big-bodied Juju Smith-Schuster, who's not that explosive, but a decent possession receiver. You have Mecole Hardman. Shorter, smaller, quick, fast. And you have Sky Moore, good route runner, fast enough, quickness. But you've got quickness, you have speed, and you have size all along this receiving core. And this takes me back to, I think, the story of the offseason. It's either teams that are taking the force multiplying wide receiver one and diversifying that portfolio into multiple assets. In this particular case with the Chiefs, there are 3 specific assets at receiver that they are using to replace Tyreek Hill: and Valdes-Scantling, Juju, and Sky Moore. And I can't wait to see it all play out. I would still rather have one Tyreek, I think. I'd rather have Tyreek plus Sky Moore. Like, that would have been doable, right? I'd rather have Tyreek plus one of those other receivers. That was doable. But all of the other players that the Chiefs have added and will add in the Tyreek Hill move, you know, we'll see. We'll see what the balance sheet looks like. But right now, it looks like the Chiefs have done well with some of those extra draft picks.
Yeah, I'm really, really excited to see what Sky Moore can do within this offense specifically. I think at 54 overall, Sky Moore was going to overachieve or outperform his draft slot regardless of who selected him. Going to the Kansas City Chiefs now with Patrick Mahomes as his quarterback, with Andy Reid as his head coach, with the offense that they've built, with Travis Kelce to take attention away, I would be very surprised if Sky Moore didn't become a very good player for them very quickly. I think that's a great pick for a team that looked at the first round, decided that the value at receiver wasn't there, and decided to wait. You know, didn't want to do anything and reach for a first rounder. Came back in the second, got Sky Moore. That is, I think, a phenomenal pick for them after those two value picks in the first round.
So three legitimate picks that we liked. Brian Cook has eventual starting potential. He was number 71 on the PFF draft board, safety out of Cincinnati. You throw him into the mix with Justin Reed and with Juan Thornhill. Leo Chanel, just, man, a fun linebacker out of Wisconsin. Kind of similar to Nick Bolton, right? Like, you don't want – Nick Bolton wasn't the best coverage player coming out, but the dude just owned the run game, and we saw that in year one for the Chiefs. Chanel, dominant run defender, 94-plus run defense grade, and he's huge, but still moves really well and just attacks offensive linemen. He is like a run game ninja. He can pass. He can rush the passer. Good blitzer.
Ninja.
He's a run game ninja. Chanel. Love him. And Darian Kennard in the fifth. I thought he might go in the second. Potential. He was a right tackle at Kentucky. Potential guard conversion. But I think you highlighted on the daily today, you know, he could legitimately compete with Lucas Niang at right tackle. And for all the other investment I think the Chiefs have made along the offensive line, Niang in the third as a developmental tackle prospect, Kennard in the fifth, I think that's a good way to balance out and maybe steal a starter between those two guys. And I think they have that option with Kennard here to try him at tackle, and if he lands at guard, yeah, good depth because he was really productive in college.
And Chanel, I think, is an example of the argument that we were making, or that I was making, on one of our mock draft shows about at some point it doesn't matter what your need is, you just take a good player when he's value. The Chiefs don't need linebackers. They have Nick Bolton, as you mentioned from last year. They have Willie Gay. They've got players at that position, and they just, and you look at a guy like Chanel, who was what, the 36th position player on PFS big board. They grab him at 103. At some point you look at that and you're like, this is just, it doesn't matter that we don't need this guy, he's too good a value at this point. And the other thing about him is he had one of the freakiest athletic profiles of any linebacker in the draft.
Yep.
For a guy that, I mean, I'm not saying it necessarily showed up on tape, but like run through his measurables and they are kind of crazy. The only thing he wasn't above the 70th percentile on was arm length, right? So relatively short arms, but we're a 6'3" guy, 250 pounds, who runs a 4.5, whose 10-yard split was a 1.5 flat. That's the 99th percentile. Bench press, 99th percentile. 34 reps. Vertical was over 40 inches, 97th percentile. Broad jump was almost 11 feet, 95th percentile. Short shuttle, under 4 seconds, 99th percentile. And a 6'8" three cone, that's 91st. So he's above the 90th percentile in essentially any meaningful metric whatsoever for athletic testing, and went in the third round.
And he's really productive in the run game and as a pass rusher. Coverage stuff, Wisconsin didn't ask him to do a whole lot. But isn't that one of those things, like, because of the athleticism, we think he can kind of figure it out. Let's get him in the building. If he does become an early down player, you know, develop his coverage skills along the way, you have the ability to do that, right, with Willie Gay and Nick Bolton, as you mentioned. There's a lot to like about that pick.
Mm-hmm.
So people could look at it as an athletic projection. I look at it as a productive player and an athletic projection all in one.
Yeah, it's perfect.
And a guy that I would absolutely take at 103.
Exactly. It's like the perfect composite of a round three pick, right? We're taking a guy with stupid athleticism who had pretty good tape and doesn't necessarily fit a position in need, but we want that player, and we'll find out how to make it all fit together later on down the line, because you have to, because that's literally how you're supposed to draft. At some point, you just take something that's way too good a value to pass up, and that's sorted out later.
One of three A-plus drafts from PFF, number three on the composite. It went Ravens, Jets, Chiefs. AFC's just winning everything this offseason. Ravens, Jets, then Chiefs, number three draft here. And look, we'll see if it pans out for the Chiefs. And even the Ravens being number one. But in an offseason where everyone else in the AFC is making the flash moves, the Browns and the Raiders and the Dolphins, the Chiefs were just sitting there like they lost Tyreek Hill. They just kind of filled the roster in. This is a huge draft for the Chiefs because their goal is winning championships. You got Patrick Mahomes as your base, and they needed to reload the roster, and I think they really did in this draft. So, like what the Chiefs did. Mm-hmm. Two more teams left.
Okay.
Las Vegas Raiders, then the Los Angeles Chargers. All right, let's go Raiders.
Well, this one shouldn't take long.
Why do you hate the Raiders?
I don't hate it. I'm just saying they didn't pick before the third round.
Davante Adams. First pick was number 90. So they didn't pick till round three, the Raiders. Consensus probably had him as trash because they picked late. Right? Now, 21st. Tied for 21st is pretty good. We had B-plus for the Raiders for a team that didn't pick till pick 90. But I like Dylan Parham quite a bit. Another guy I thought as a guard could go in round two. A productive Memphis guard. He's another one I thought would thought the Niners would covet him for their spot at left guard in their zone-heavy system. The Raiders probably bringing, you know, Josh McDaniels' system over from the Patriots. They were going to run a lot more gap scheme and rely on a little bit more power from their guards. I like Parham from a movement standpoint and from a production standpoint. Number 67 on our board, they get him at 90.
Yeah. There were a few teams that did that whole trick of trading away all their consequential picks but still had like actual needs to fill, you know, starting spots available. The Raiders are one of them. They didn't pick till 90 and got a player that could easily start day one for them and be an upgrade. That, to me, is fantastic value.
I like that as well. Yeah, absolutely.
And Parham's intriguing because this is a guy with a 90-plus PFF grade in 2020, a tackle. And then was an undersized player. But every time he stepped on a scale, he became less undersized and then wound up being not undersized at all. Right? At one point, he was like a 285-pound tackle. And now you're like, well, that doesn't exist at the NFL level. Like, that's prohibitively small, right? So to the point where it doesn't really matter how good you are, there's a limit to how high we can take you because you're going to need to put on 20 pounds at that size to even be viable in the NFL. He ended up getting up to 311, which is like prototypical size, particularly for, and then kicks inside. Like, we're no longer in undersized territory at all. And if you're not an undersized player, there's good tape on his resume and position flexibility. I mean, that's just a freaking great pick in the third round.
Yeah, I really like him, and we'll see what they end up doing with Alex Leatherwood last year's first round pick. Like, we liked Leatherwood as a second round prospect. It wasn't like we thought he was a disaster; just didn't want to take him at 17 or whatever it was. 17. But Leatherwood ended up kicking into right guard. I would still maybe give him a shot to go back to tackle, see if he could develop there. But yeah, you've got some flexibility there for the Raiders offensive line. They go running back Zamir White, fourth round. I mean, this is where when it's your second pick of the draft and you do have other holes on the roster, it's not great. I don't think picking any running back, but they got some size, you know, 217 pounds, 4.4 speed. Add him to the mix with Josh Jacobs. They did not. I mean, this is the thing, right? I think they're going to just get cheaper at running back. They're not going to pay Josh Jacobs, most likely. They turned down his fifth-year option. I don't think they're looking to get him long-term, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they are. I don't know. Kenyon Drake, the last regime, paid money for, so you're getting cheaper with Zamir White, at least as a fourth-round pick. Neil Farrell and Matthew Butler, back-to-back picks that add some defensive line depth. I mean, the interior of the defensive line has been an issue for a few years now with the Raiders, so they're going to come in and just get younger there. You know, Butler's we liked that pick a lot. You know, it was a 130 on the PFF draft board. They get him at 175. So not a great interior defensive line class, but he was number 7 in our group. He's round 5. He's got a chance to compete there. So,
yeah, I mean, Butler,
I think they did well with their picks overall.
Butler and Munford, the offensive lineman from Ohio State, in the 5th and the 7th round for them, those guys could contribute. Like, they're not.
Yeah, Munford's in there to compete as well.
When you're
for sure.
5th round and beyond is usually a throwaway pick. But those guys, there's a pathway to playing time for both those guys. I would say that, you know, Parham's got a chance to start. Maybe Leatherwood kicks back out to right tackle and we run that again for a second time. But if Leatherwood's as bad at right tackle in year two as he was in year one, you're going to see an offensive line reshuffle pretty quickly. And if that happens, all of a sudden Munford is like in the discussion to playing time.
Isn't this a very Rams-like move, though, all of this? So they made the big move for Davante Adams.
Well, that's what you need to do. I mean,
yes. Very Rams-like, because all of their picks, two guards, well, guard slash tackles, two running backs, two interior defensive linemen. I mean, this is almost to a T the positions that are of lower value, that are not breaking the bank in free agency, where you can steal starters in the draft and keep those positions cheap, presumably because in the future, well, you just paid Derek Carr, yeah. You just paid Devontae Adams because you're going to spend your money at high-value positions and you're going to steal starters at guard, at running back, and at interior defensive line, and you do it in the draft. It was very that's part of the Rams' strategy that people always forget that other part that they connect. It's not just get rid of all the draft picks. It's get starters
right
on day two and three.
Obviously, the key is always do you actually hit on any of these guys?
Sure, of course.
But theoretically, this is the right idea, and because of where these guys rank relative to PFF's board, we think they've done well in attempting this. Now, it doesn't mean they hit on all of them, and if they don't, then none of it matters. But on paper, this is a great draft for the Raiders, given how far behind the eight ball they were in terms of not having draft capital, right? Parham in the third, fantastic value. As you said, Zamir White, they're getting cheaper at running back. It's fine. Butler in the fifth to add to the defensive line. That has a chance to make an impact. Munford in the seventh has a chance to make an impact. This is a good draft.
The other Rams-like thing here, it is, you remember I read on the video we did on the Titans way back on draft night, I like read off the 10 players that they're paying $10 million plus to. The Raiders only have five. It's a top-heavy roster as far as finances go. Derek Carr is over 40 now. Devontae Adams, 28 per year. Colton Miller, over 18, their starting left tackle. And on the defensive side of the ball, it's just Max Crosby, who they just re-signed, mm-hmm. and Chandler Jones, who they signed in free agency, 23 and 17. There's no one else on the defense over $5 million. Bilal Nichols is the only guy, actually $5.5 million. Everyone else is kind of cheap. Is this part of the overhaul? Is this part of, like, get those core players for a lot of money? But this is the type of draft where if you don't have the picks, you're finding guys on the cheap. They're going to fit in because you've got this top-heavy salary structure right now on the team. And, I kind of like it for the Raiders. So the fact that they ranked 21st without picking until round three, another thing that I think shows the consensus seemed to like this draft here for the Raiders.
Mm-hmm.
And what do we say? B+? Yeah, B+ per PFF. Let's wrap it up with the Chargers. Where did they rank? They're in the middle, too. 17th. They tied for 17th with the Carolina Panthers in the consensus. B from PFF. They go Zion Johnson in the first round. So we theorized a couple different ways that the Chargers could go in a very aggressive offseason, right? If Jameson Williams fell, would they just add that speed thread? But they ended up going with a need, right? They have a need at right guard or right tackle. I'm guessing Zion Johnson's going to play guard for them.
Mm-hmm.
But he's played tackle in the past. You could see if he could fail there. You can move Matt Filer around. You've got some flexibility. But Zion Johnson had no second-round pick and came back with safety JT Woods out of Baylor in the third round.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on the Chargers?
I mean, first-round pick, fine, good, standard. They take the need. They got a good player that fits the need. That's about all you can ask for. It's unspectacular. It's a guard. You're never gonna be doing cartwheels overdrafting a guard in the first round. But yeah, that's a fine pick. It's a position they absolutely needed to address because the last thing they want to do is see that offensive line that they rebuilt in front of Justin Herbert collapse around him because they've let a couple of players walk away. So good pick. JT Woods is an interesting one in the third round. Dude never had a PFF grade above 67 in a season. So again, another example of like we have not seen the production from this guy. We've seen speed, we've seen playmaking ability, we've seen flashes. We have not seen consistently high-end play, and we'll see if they can get that out of him, given that he is the kind of athlete that he is. But this is a good defensive coach, a good system for that to happen in. So, okay, benefit of the doubt, third round, let's see how they get on with that.
You don't see that size-speed
right
combo from JT Woods all that often. 6'2", 195. 195 is kind of small for safety, but 4.36, 40-inch vertical. I mean, we're talking 90th plus percentile in all the explosion measures. And as we say here, third round?
That's where you take those guys.
You take those guys.
I mean, we said that
sure
all the way through. It's just why it makes the – that's just what makes the Draymond Walker pick so funny, is that every other one of these like freaky athletes that don't have great production, it's like, that's a good third-round pick. Draymond Walker, number one overall. All right, fine.
It's a little bit different. It's difficult to love the Chargers draft, though, too, when it's like, all right, you have round one. You don't have a round two pick. Woods is the guy in the third who's, athletic projection.
Mm-hmm.
Fourth round's a running back and Isaiah Spiller. A lot of people are kind of high on Spiller, it seemed. We had him at 150 on the board. I think he's a good gap scheme runner. I don't think he's, you know, anything special. But
well, that's not an unreasonable pick in the fourth, given, you know, they've got Austin Eckler. They kind of need a you know, complimentary type of piece. And the fourth round is where you're supposed to get that. It's just that they didn't have a second rounder, so it feels like a higher pick for them because it's their third selection overall.
Another athletic projection in the seventh round in Leonard, from the cornerback from Mississippi. But Jamari Sawyer, the sixth round tackle slash guard out of Georgia too.
Love that pick.
It's a lot like the Raiders double dipped at a position where the second player was a starter on a pretty good, you know, either Ohio State or Georgia had production. So Sawyer probably comes in and competes, and maybe he could steal that right tackle job because the alternative was Storm Norton last year, right? So I like that too, because there's a combination of players who could potentially start on the offensive line and athletic projections there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I when we did the sort of roundup grades on the PFF draft show on that on the Sunday after the draft, I gave this draft, I think, an A or an A minus or something. On reflection, like looking at it again, I'm not quite as high on it as I was.
You were factoring in round two was Khalil Mack.
Maybe. No.
You would never do that. It's against your nature.
It's a decent draft, but I'm a little bit less high on it sort of now in the cold light of day than I was right at the time. It's probably literally just because it wasn't that long since they selected Sawyer in the sixth round, which is one of my favorite picks of the draft. I might have colored it a little bit.
Yeah, perhaps. But yeah, they've got some offensive line depth there. Spiller's going to step in, do some things. JT Woods is interesting, especially if you do give him a year to develop. You've got Nasir Adderley at free safety, former second-round pick. He's in the last year of his contract. He hasn't had a great career. He's been okay, but certainly a guy that they can't, with the player's contract coming up soon, can't invest too much in the secondary. So Woods is going to have a shot to play, perhaps, if not this year, then next year, and be one of your cheaper options in the secondary. Because another team, when you look at where they're spending their money, $27 million for Joey Bosa, $23.5 million for Khalil Mack, $16.5 million for J.C. Jackson, over $8 million for Sebastian Joseph Day and Michael Davis. That's on the defensive side. Austin Johnson's over $7 million. That's a lot of money on the defensive side of the ball. So they're going to have some cheap players there. Over $20 million for both of their receivers, and of course, Justin Herbert coming up soon for the Chargers.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that's the 32nd team that we've broken down here in 4 days.
Okay.
Is that it?
That's that whole division?
Broncos, Denver. Chiefs, Raiders,
and Chargers.
Chargers.
Yeah. I believe
Seahawks. We forgot about the Seahawks in the AFC West.
Yeah, I believe we're done.
When I was a kid, Seattle was in the AFC. How many of our listeners remember that? 75% at least, right? We don't trend that young. Anything else on the Chargers? I get nothing else on the Chargers.
No, I don't think so.
We spent a lot of time on the rest of their offseason, which was aggressive. Khalil Mack and J.C. Jackson coming in. I like it. I like what they're capable of doing there with the Chargers. The AFC West is going to be, as you would say, madness. Broncos and Russell Wilson, Justin Herbert and the Chargers, Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs, and Derek Carr and Devontae Adams with the Raiders.
Yeah.
Carr needs the receiver there to put him over the top. That's going to be a crazy division, man. And one of these teams that's really good is going to win 7 or 8 games. It's going to happen.
Probably.
And it's going to be a disappointing season, but they're going to beat each other up. So the AFC West is absolutely loaded. All right, man, what else do we have to wrap this thing up here?
And we're done now, right? That's it. That's the draft.
I will forget about the draft until August when I'm like, oh, yeah, they drafted this guy. So we're in off-season mode. Please contact us. The emails are flowing in. There was actually a really good email here. I might want to read this quickly. Thought process on running backs just came in while we were on the show. Brian Kuhn. Sam and Steve, I think there's a strong possibility the coaches view these running backs that they draft earlier as guys that make life easier. And he goes on to say, look, decision's made by a person, and you put in long hours, and you're doing all these things, and maybe the running back just doesn't require as much thought process as far as game planning and all that stuff. And basically saying sometimes you make personnel decisions in business, you know, give me less of a headache, you know? I think that's interesting. You said the NFL might value from that perspective. I'd certainly hire an employee I have to spend less time planning for than one I have to manage more often and accommodate, all else being equal. Any thoughts on that? The running back is the make my life easier employee. Just put him out there. Don't have to do anything for him. Take the handoff and run to daylight. Go.
Yeah. I mean, look, nobody's ever – the whole analysis around running backs, nobody's ever found it difficult, I think, to understand why running backs are picked. You know, it's not like – it's not a mystery of sort of, what are these guys doing? Like the problem was more – the more information we collect about running backs and how the run game works and how football generally works, the more the information suggests that the original thought process was not necessarily correct. And it's more a case of like retooling or reshaping conventional wisdom and what you thought about all these things. It's not like we never knew how this, we didn't know, it was a mystery. We have no idea why people were like, you go back, you don't have to go back that far where running backs were consistent number one overall draft picks. People thought running back was the thing that made everything work. And maybe you go back that far, you were closer to a reality where that was true. But the more the NFL has moved, the more that's just not true. So I think the bottom line is I understand why teams take running backs high. Even teams like the Shanahans, who have got a pretty in-your-face body of evidence that says you shouldn't.
You still want good running backs.
Yeah.
You don't want to have there is a difference in skill level.
Right.
And it just comes down to the difference in skill level showing up production-wise.
That, I think, is why specifically that coaching tree of guys are still taking them high and higher than people think they should, because they believe that that difference in skill level is actually more significant than you think it is or the data thinks it is. You know, they believe that there's still a material difference that makes an impact on the roster overall that is worth expending a second-round pick on or whatever. So it makes sense. I don't disagree with the idea. I think that's why it's always been done. The whole point is, you know, the more information you get, the more it suggests you might not want to go that route.
Thanks to Brian Kuhn for the email. So my point in all of this was send us more emails, because the emails are going to drive the rest of the spring and summer. They're going to drive our shows.
Where do people send the emails, Steve?
NFLpodcast@pff.com.
There you go.
Podcast singular.
Right on the screen.
NFLpodcast@pff.com. You can tweet us at @PFFNFLpod. Don't tweet us. Actually, follow us on Twitter.
We'll do both.
And follow that TikTok, @PFFNFLpodcast on TikTok, where you're becoming a star, Sam.
Yeah, over 1,000 followers now. It's really
you're catching up to Rick Spielman with the viral TikTok.
Sure. It's going through the roof right now.
Well, that's our draft review. 4 shows. Be sure to go back and review if you didn't catch any of them. Don't forget, 25% off using the promo code NFLPOD. PFF NFL Daily, too. Keep sending me screenshots. I'll send out one more edge before we the Daily for the summer.
As long as we have this audience, let's send people to my TikTok. Let's get some free followers for nothing, you know?
How are we going to do that? No.
Tell
we got
to
go.
It is. Sam Monson.
We'll be back on Monday.
@ Sam Monson Talks, TOKS. Follow my TikTok and get me some free followers.
I'll do Steve Palazzolo talks.
You should. What are you going to do in your TikTok?
Probably some film breakdowns.
Dances.
Yeah. A lot of dances. Probably from sidelines of football games. I think that's the way to do it.
Yeah. Okay. Are we out? Are we done? Can we stop recording this?
The analytics say 2-hour shows are better, so I'm going to prolong it for another minute.
Oh, for another minute?
I'm just kidding. They don't. Thanks to everybody for tuning in. We'll see you Monday morning, 9 a.m.